Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. In recent years, Tajikistan is on the agenda for many things. Unfortunately, most of them has to do with negative developments. That includes restrictions on civil liberties, crackdown against political pluralism, and above all, raising personality cult of the president. Now, a group of Western academics and scholars are saying that there is another group or sector which is severely under threat, and that is academic freedom. And they say there is need for immediate response by the international community to save it. Today on the Majlis, we will discuss what is that academics are worried about and what can the international community do about it. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Dr. Ed Schatz, who's the professor at the University of Toronto, Canada, with background in post-Soviet space. Nazira Sodat Sayoruba is with us. She's joining from New York today. She is currently a research fellow at the Central Asia Program of George Washington University, also doing her PhD at Tsukuba University of Japan. Nazira is from Tajikistan. Bruce Panier is with us from Prague, who is the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog called Kishlak Owazi. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. So, Dr. Schatz, let's start with you. Tell us, please, the backstory of your recent report on academic restrictions in Tajikistan. In fact, your report is the reason why we are talking about this topic today on the Majlis.
Sure. Thanks for having me. It's a short report really designed to start a conversation about issues of academic freedom in Tajikistan. It could be extended to other kinds of contexts in Central Asia or beyond, but principally we're concerned with Tajikistan in this piece. The backstory is that John Heathershaw and I, who've worked together on a variety of different scholarly endeavors, we just co-edited a book that came out recently, have had a variety of conversations about academic freedom and the decreasing space for academic freedom, in particular in Tajikistan. The genesis for this goes back to 2014, where you may recall an incident in which in June of 2014, when a PhD student from the University of Toronto, Alexander Sadikov, was working under contract with the University of Exeter, but in Tajikistan, and was just starting to do his first interview for a project with John Heathershaw, when he was arrested, eventually charged with some pretty serious crimes of treason and espionage. And after a sustained campaign that lasted 36 days, there were a lot of different moving parts and a lot of international attention focused on the case. Eventually, Sadikov was released and allowed to go back to Canada. And one of the things that the episode reminded me and John of was, you know, how many terrific people there are both inside Tajikistan and outside of it who are deeply committed to academic freedom and to the basic principles of scholarship that is autonomous and has, you know, independent capacity. And, you know, after the incident, John and I were hopeful, right? We thought things would get better because there were a series of misunderstandings, misinterpretations that ultimately led to the arrest of Sadikov. And we thought that basically, you know, people were wiser after the incident. As it turned out, we were wrong. Things has, as you described in the intro, things have gotten much worse in Tajikistan in a variety of ways. You know, on the political front, you see the shutdown of the Islamic Renaissance Party, forcing many members to flee abroad. You know, the persecution of the relatives of IRP leadership, those who remain in Tajikistan. Wow. There are reports of torture and these kinds of things on the political front. Journalists, I mean, this has been a story, but, you know, for a while, but the harassment has been kicked up even further in 2016, 2017. Recently, people like Khairullo Mirsaidov was, you know, he was arrested after publishing an open letter that essentially called for a crackdown on high-level corruption. So, you know, the story of repression goes on and on. The religious front, right, people being forced to shave their beards or trim their beards, surveillance on mosques being stepped up and this kind of stuff.
Yeah, obviously we are going to talk later a little bit whether restrictions on the academic freedom has any connection to other broader restrictions that we are seeing in Tajikistan recently. We will come to that. Dr. Schatz, just to follow up with you, you also mentioned during your description of the situation some red lines. Can you go a little bit deep into that? What those red lines means? Is there any taboo topics that when academics touch gets in trouble, or in general you are seeing this negative trend going against them?
Well, I think in these contexts there always have been certain red lines that, I mean, Nazira might know better. But certain red lines that seem clear to me were, you know, don't directly implicate the president. That much is clear. I mean, of course, there are laws against defaming the president and things like that. But the concern now is the wider interpretation of that and the willingness to use any number of laws with the widest possible interpretation, so as to bring into line academics who might appear to the authorities to be too critical. So I guess we no longer know, and this is the main point, we no longer know where the red lines are, and Tajik academics may not know where the red lines are either, right? And so people have to, out of an abundance of caution, exercise self-censorship to an extent that just really stifles the academic enterprise. It's not that different from what you see among some journalists in terms of the pressure they're facing. But again, we could talk about that separately.
Okay, Nazira, so tell us, please, how these developments, the one described by Dr. Schatz, is seen within Tajikistan? And also, second leg of my question is going to be about these red lines. How do you, as a Tajik academics, navigate those, in many cases, unmarked red lines?
I think the issues are multi-layered. Mm-hmm. They are not like from the bottom to the from the top to the bottom, but now they are happening. The red lines is happening from the bottom to the top. For example, as an academic researcher, when I went to Tajikistan, I was feeling it is from the bottom. When you interview people, they know what to say and how to tell you. And even sometimes when they go beyond whatever they want to share, and they say, this is not for your thesis. This is just between us. And I think these are the red lines to me that make you conscious what to write and what not to write, which also makes the life of the academics is very difficult. It is already, the pressure is not from the top, and from the bottom is giving you like conscious red lines to be careful what to write. If you write everything, then you are putting your interview researchers under the pressure. So this is, to me, this one is like becoming most important, that issue is becoming in the bottom level as well, which are becoming very sensitive. When they listen to your topic, immediately some people would say that this is very sensitive, I cannot answer to your questions. And to me, it takes my freedom already, that I cannot communicate to people because there is already most of the topics becoming very sensitive.
That's very interesting. So Bruce, you heard Nazira in Dr. Schatz. Now, how do you explain these negative developments, especially in the timeline that Dr. Schatz was talking about?
Well, there's been a growing tendency on the part of all these governments, some started earlier than others, but to control the entire narrative of their society. And it's extended now into like their history, too. The government has a version of events that they put out. That's the version that they want everyone to accept as being the sole truth. You know, in the case of Alexander Sadikov, and Ed can correct me if I'm wrong here, but he was doing research in conflict in eastern Tajikistan, right? Now, the Tajik government has their version of what is going on in eastern Tajikistan. And if they get the idea that someone is going to have an alternative explanation for what's going on, this kind of bothers them. I mean, you could kind of call them control freaks, but it's strange to watch the evolution of this. Obviously, they wanted to control the media so that their version of events was getting out first and if possible, would be the only event, the only version that was out there. But it's extended into education, too, where there's a lot of, and you just never know when you're going to bump up against some of this stuff. You would think, for example, history would be something that would be a more or less a safe topic to do. But I remember even in the 90s, I was writing about, why did Uzbekistan choose Tamerlane as the father of the Uzbeks? And I pulled a quote from an old book by René Grosset, The Empire of the Steppes, that described Tamerlane as a Persianized Mongol Turk. And there I was actually academics from Uzbekistan who wrote to me on email to explain that I was wrong, And my knowledge of history was flawed, you know, and that was just a small example of what's happening out there where, you know, instead of like saying, I see your explanation and let me offer you another explanation of this and see if we can, you know, go back and forth with this, you know, it's just blanket, you're wrong, because we know, because we already have our own version of this story.
Mm-hmm. Recently, we also have seen increasing restrictions in many other aspects, like our own colleagues, for example, in Tajikistan, were gotten into increasing scrutiny. And also, there are some negative developments on the political atmosphere of the country. What connection there is between the restriction on academic freedom and the other negative developments that has been happening there?
If we were talking about what happened to our to Azadi, our Tajik service, yeah. then yes, you know, and we know why that happened, too, is because this was prior to the banning of the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan, and we were reporting on the problems that they had. And there was a group of correspondents out there that were not dedicated to that, but anyway, that was pretty much their beat. They covered what was happening with the Islamic Renaissance Party. And they were it was them that got in trouble. I mean, by extension, the whole bureau out there had problems, but the ones that were on the list of the Tajik government were the ones that were covering the Islamic Renaissance Party. So, you know, and this gets back to the same thing with in some ways, it parallels what happened to Alexander Sadikov when he went out there, too, was he was doing a topic that the government thought, for whatever reason, could present some danger to them, that if someone would offer up another explanation of what was going on, people would listen to that and go, well, if the government was wrong with this or didn't tell us everything about this one topic, then maybe that's true of a lot of topics that are the government tells us about. So that would be my explanation.
Yeah, Dr. Schatz, like the fact that Tajikistan was freer, I'm not going to say free, but freer, better, at least to some level of activities involving academics, and as you mentioned earlier, then suddenly things has changed. Is there anything that academics might have done which made authorities suspicious about?
Well, let me just, before I answer that question, let me just agree with Bruce and add one little tiny bit. I mean, I think Bruce is absolutely right that there's this, over the past few years, we've seen this rising suspicion and this rising appetite on the part of authorities to scrutinize at least or pressure where possible the academic community and really any community that seems to produce independent knowledge. I guess I would say that, you know, what Bruce described in terms of the production of history has been politicized for a long time in these contexts, right? I mean, there's been an official history in Tajikistan. It shifts from, you know, generation to generation, what they emphasize, the eras and these kinds of things. But what is new now is this appetite for closing down space, right? So the official stuff has always been there. That's been continuous. But closing down space on issues of history. If in the 90s there was sort of a pluralism by default, right, because you had a state that didn't, or a regime that didn't have the capacity to engineer crackdowns, and maybe not the appetite. I'm talking about the late 90s or early 2000s. Now you have a regime that, for whatever series of reasons, both has the ability to crack down and an interest in doing so. So it's a bit of a challenge that way. Question is, have Western academics or foreign academics in general done anything to sort of prompt to this? You know, it's hard for me to say in a blanket way that no, you know, Western scholars have misstepped or done something that, you know, I mean, I think that would be silly. There's a whole lot of people doing a lot of different work, and one of the things that we've discovered and talked about a lot on the Western academic side is the need for training Western academics more squarely in the ethics of doing field work. Right. I mean, this is something that we don't do particularly good job on. So we don't think about the kinds of ethical considerations about, you know, going in some cases halfway around the world to study a different culture and context. Having said that, I think it would be academics are interested in producing knowledge.
Yeah.
Right. They're interested in producing knowledge. They're interested in interviewing people or in consulting documents or in conducting, you know, a participant observation. Their purpose is to produce knowledge, and I don't think that thinking of them as somehow, Sadika was accused of being a foreign agent, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know a few things about some of the reasons why he was accused of that, and they're all just, it's basically, it comes down to, he was on a British project and he was too close to the Brits. And at the moment in time that this sort of unfolded, the Brits were pretty critical of the deteriorating human rights record in Tajikistan. And so by association, by crude association, Sadiko must have been up to no good, which is, you know, a narrative that is easy to spin if in the context of rising suspicion, you know, conspiracy theories and sense of encirclement and all of these kinds of things that we're aware of. So, you know, maybe if Western scholars are guilty of something, it's a bit of naivete about how quickly the red lines can shift. But, I don't think that Western scholars should do too much differently. I mean, our main commitment is to producing knowledge, and that's a commitment that's shared by scholars around the world.
Nazira, tell us, please, when you talk to your colleagues in the academia in Tajikistan, what they say, what they talk about these days, about the academic restrictions, what kind of impression you get from them?
Well, let me add to the question about Western scholars from the cultural perspective, whether they contributed anything or not. This is just them adding from my own point of view in regard of Western scholars and like culturally. In our culture, we have like, if you have an issue should be kept inside your family and you should solve it within your family. And it is, I believe it is in the country as well. And when Western scholars come and interview anything and then they publish it and they write it openly and critically, then I think it impacts a lot the people mind and other people. For example, there are some topics that they are called taboo even during Soviet time about sexuality and other things. But when you see some of them openly describe how it is and what and how it happens in the context, then I believe it impacts even intellectuals. Some of them, they criticized how come they are interviewing these people and then describing everything openly. So I believe these small things also can impact a lot on the debate and discussion, which took source from the past, from maybe 1990s and until now. And that's why I said the issues are multi-layered and we should go deeper and see how the issues are impacting each other. Even in Horog, when I was there, one lady, I don't mention her name, she came and interviewed me. And I said that you should ask first my consent. Why are you interviewing without getting my consent? Sometimes even Western scholars, they come and interview people without informing them that they are interviewing and they are publishing their thoughts in the article and in the books. So these, I believe these are, to me, unethical things also sometimes happen. So this is, I wanted to add to the, whether Western scholars contributed or not. It depends on each scholar, how they come and interview people and then how they view and critically analyze the issues that are happening in the context.
Okay, thank you very much. The trajectory is negative in all fronts. Now, what impact it's having on quality of education in academic research, and what can international community do about it, as the report calls for? We will continue the discussion talking about this and many other questions shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Majlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast, we are discussing deteriorating environment for academic research in Tajikistan and its possible reason and impact. Joining me in the discussion are Dr. Ed Schatz, who is the professor at the University of Toronto, Canada, and the author of the recent report on increasing academic restrictions in Tajikistan, and Nazira Sodat Sayorova is joining us, who is an academic from Tajikistan, currently doing her PhD on educational mobility of Tajikistani students. We also have Bruce Panier, who is in Prague, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog called Kishlag Owazi. I am Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, colleagues. So, in this part, we will discuss the impact of academic restrictions on academia, and what can the international community do about it? So, Dr. Schatz, to begin with you, so what to do about this? You called upon international community to respond and suggested a couple of possible approaches. Tell us, what can possibly be done about this by the international community?
Thanks for that question. What can we do? You know, when John Heatherson and I sat down to discuss these issues and eventually write this piece, I mean, we really wanted to sort of start a conversation. So we don't pretend to know all the answers, but we do in this piece, you know, provide a few ideas for discussion. And I'm really grateful that Nazira and Bruce are both here to give us their perspectives. I mean, I think that one of the things that's not in the piece, but that I'll just describe briefly, because it comes from Nazira's earlier comments about ethics. And I think one of the things that foreign scholars can do better than we have in the past, I mean, you know, scholars in the West are trained in foreign languages, we're trained in the culture and the history of the places that we study, we're trained in theories, we're trained in all kinds of methods of inquiry, whether it's statistics or, you know, how to conduct interviews or all these kinds of things. One of the things that we do less of a good job in is providing training on how to confront ethical issues as they emerge in the field. There are discussions about ethics, but they're very abstract. And what we need to do better, I think, in the Western Academy is help Western academics to sort of exercise those ethical muscles, right? Hmm. We need to be constantly reminding ourselves that, you know, life is full of ethical questions and they'll surprise you all the time. And I think exercising those muscles is an important thing that Western scholars can do. And this, you know, Nazira's comments, I think, are right on that. But in the piece, we go through a couple of ideas, going from a sort of more radical, more extreme version to less. And we start with the idea of, what about a total boycott of the Tajik Academy? Yeah. In other words, calling on scholars in the West to sit fully and completely disengage, on universities and think tanks to fully and completely disengage from Tajikistan on the notion that the environment is so poisoned and that any kind of engagement with the institutions in the country would simply empower those elements of the authoritarian regime that would squelch scholarship. So no real scholarship can come from it, and our grant money should not be spent through cooperation. We ultimately decide this is not a good idea. It's too extreme. It probably couldn't be enforced in the first place. And Tajikistan has, you know, pockets of scholarship that's effective and clear and engaging and important. And so it, we don't want to squelch that. The second idea we go through is a more limited kind of a more selective, what we call a blacklist, right? Maybe identify those particularly, you know, offenders within the home context that seem to be repressing scholars, those kinds of environments in which whatever work is produced really isn't research, that it's there's not enough autonomy for scholars in those kinds of contexts, and so therefore more selective disengagement from these places would make sense. There are some problems with that. Ultimately, we think that would be a hard thing to enforce as well. It's also hard to get good information on what exactly is going on within particular, you know, institutions within the academy. So where we settle in the end is on calling for scholars in the West to be critically engaged. We call for critical engagement with the region, and this is kind of a common sense notion. What we want to do is sort of put in the foreground these kinds of considerations. Well, we want to encourage people in the West to exercise caution before entering into any kind of academic exchange, any kind of cooperation. Do serious due diligence, not just say you're doing due diligence, but actually look into the institution that you're potentially cooperating with to see what kind of institution this actually represents before embarking on anything. And it's not to say don't embark on it. It's just to say, you know, do your homework first. And then secondly, raise awareness about, you know, cases of clear persecution. And there have been, unfortunately, a variety. We mentioned six different ones that we're aware of that are recent. You could add the Sadiqov case to that. There may be many more that we're not aware of, but the idea is that we need to raise awareness about these kinds of cases because we care about academic freedom. You know, is this a human rights issue? It may be all sorts of other things as well, yeah. But for us as scholars, what we can talk about is the value of academic freedom. Again, to the scholarly community, but also to the home societies, right? Okay. Tajikistan is not going to flourish without a thriving, autonomous academic community.
Let me take Nazira's point in this. So, Nazira, you heard Dr. Schatz were discussing three different options how to respond to this increasing restrictions on academic freedom in Tajikistan. So the first is total boycott. The second is selective blacklist. And the third option would be, vigilant and also critical of the situation when it's relevant. So as a Tajik academic, what was going on through your mind when these options were discussed?
I was like, when the first option, I was like, wow, it is too radical. It is to, again, to take the freedom, of course, from the scholars. If you want to show that you should be open, but still we are ourselves is taking the freedom from the other people who want to contribute. And I said it would be like a children play. If you do not play, I don't give you a candy. So it is too much radical. But what I thought is important is to there is international, I see international and local scholars. Mm-hmm. They're working very separately in two different corners. Mm-hmm. And what is important, if you want to take an action, then our action should bring results. Mm-hmm. So what kind of result we want to see in maybe within 10 years or in the future within 5 or 10 years. So it is important to bring the voices of local people and to invite all the scholars that are globally local, but at the same time today they are global. They can also contribute to the discussion and solution of finding out ways. And of course, within 1 or 2 minutes, it is hard to find out solutions. But I think it is important to bring the voices of local scholars who are today international and to work together with international scholars to come up with the ideas and solutions, because they know about history and they have grown in the culture, so they can contribute to new ideas of which way to find out. Because even this kind of persecutions is not something new to Tajikistan. It is coming from the history. Even if you go back to 10th century, we can see it.
Dr. Schatz, feel free to respond if there's anything you want to add into this. Bruce, you
sure.
Also? Yeah, Bruce.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think Nazira's got it exactly right, that the boycott is too radical. I mean, in a way, that's sort of a rhetorical device in the piece, right, to say start with the most radical and then move to something that we think is more justifiable. The more justifiable one is really to do your homework before you engage. I mean, there are local scholars and there are local scholars. And some, you know, there are many, many local scholars that are doing serious and important work. There are others that are producing work that is more really the product of current political imperatives. And so, you know, they might not have the autonomy to do that kind. So it's which international local connections are desirable and productive. And you're right about the results. One of the things that I'm aware of, are two things that are sort of worth mentioning here. The Central Eurasian Studies Society, which is a major international area studies association committed to the study of Central Asia, has developed a sort of travel grant program so that people from the region can continue to travel to the conference of the CESS, which happens in North America every year, and then once every other year in the region itself. And I think it's a really useful thing, in part because, well, money is necessary to travel these kinds of long distances. But, you know, particularly over the last couple of years, we've seen deteriorating both political and economic conditions, making it harder for people from the region to travel. So it's been a nice initiative, and there have been like something like 30 grants each year, which is a lot. So we have a good proportion of the conference, which is, you know, local voices of various sorts at that conference. A second thing, just to mention very briefly, is there's a new academic journal in the making. It's not official yet, but it looks like it will be official soon. So I won't give too many details, but it's designed to highlight the scholarship of those people from the region who may not actually be, you know, using English as their first language. The journal will be in English, but the idea is to give a voice to local scholars, give priority to local scholars in conversations that scholars have about the region. And I think it's really, really important because English is the language of the academic community globally. People whose English is not as good as Nazira's sometimes get marginalized, but in fact, they often do terrific scholarship, and their voices should be heard.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, Bruce, in the face of this reality, what solution do you see going forward for academics in Tajikistan?
Well, there has to be some kind of attempt to convince the authorities in all these countries that it's in their best interests to allow education to run its course and bloom as much as possible. This is going to be a strange example, but you know, if you look at what Kazakhstan has done, and of course, there's a lot of problems in Kazakhstan, right? But the Bolshak program and Nazarbayev University, I would regard as successes, and this has not only ensured that there is going to be an educated next generation and generation after that, but in a lot, I would be willing to bet that after Nazarbayev is dead, history, at least as it's written in Kazakhstan, will remember him very, very well, in large part because of these very intelligent, very bright and talented people who have benefited from these kind of programs. Whereas if we look at a country like Turkmenistan, for instance, which never did any of this stuff, Niyazov is almost forgotten, you know, and that's by design, of course, by the current leadership. And Karimov is headed in the same direction. And both those countries turn their backs on cooperation with outside educational institutions. And so I think that, you know, I hesitate to use Nazarbayev University and Bolshak as an example, but there's got to be a way to get through to these governments that say, look, for your own posterity, not for the well-being of your people, you need to have a level of cooperation with people outside, with you know, educators, with students, with educational institutions outside your country that guarantees that your country is not going to be some third world backwater, you know, 100 years from now, you know, and that you personally, you people in government will be well remembered for having had the vision to open the doors to education for your people and not and bring them forward rather than watching them go backward. And let's face it, in a lot of Central Asian countries right now, really most, you know, the education system is that they inherited from the Soviet Union has fallen apart.
Yeah, I know, Dr. Schatz, you want to leave us. Also, it's time that we end our discussion. Unless there's anything that you would like to add, I'm planning to wrap up the discussion here.
Well, let me just briefly add, I think Bruce is completely right. Mm-hmm. I mean, convincing these leaders may be a tough order, but I guess the, you know, the limited experience that I've had in the region, Nazir has a lot more, obviously, you know, suggests that there are always allies in this cause, you know, within a complex regime, right? So it may be that you know, approaching the president may not be the right way to go. It may be that approaching, you know, somebody who has the president's ear, who is very sympathetic to this, is the way to go. And I would say that there's a particular, I would say, perilous moment we're in globally when it comes to scholarship and sort of, I mean, there are attacks on education even in and on scholarship even in the United States. Right. Yeah. And maybe we see these in other kinds of contexts where we thought that the value of independent scholarship was recognized. And in fact, I guess we can't take it as an article of faith that everyone shares that sense that autonomous scholarship is valuable for the broader society. So academics need to do a better job of communicating, you know, the value of what we're doing, even on these very specialized, sometimes esoteric topics.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Nazira, do you want to add a final note? Like, what is the best path for the concerned Western academics to move forward on Tajikistan? Any advice?
I think one important thing is to give awareness to the local scholars through open access. Those scholars who are in Tajikistan today, they are not in the debate. They are not in the discussion. Some of them, although their English is very good and they cannot come to West and Europe, they are in the context of Tajikistan and they don't know what is happening about their region in the West and in Europe. So one way maybe is to start to open those academic literature that we have in the Western Europe to open up to the local scholars to give them knowledge and understanding about the region, because there are lots of research, whatever is going on in the West, most of them, they don't know it. Even I myself, when I was in Tajikistan, I couldn't get access to any Western or European literature. You have to be part of any university, then you can get access. So this is another freedom that we should think in future to give to the scholars, and through this to start the discussion and debate and conversation with the local scholars. This is what I think is important as well for our local scholars.
Okay. Well, thank you, Nazira Saudatayoruba, an academic from Tajikistan. And also big thanks goes to Dr. Ed Schatz, who's the professor at the University of Toronto, Canada, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog, Shlok Awazi. Thank you, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you, Mohammed. Pleasure.
Thank you very much.
So this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia podcast. Until next week. Bye-bye.